Our final case this morning is United States against Spence.
May it please the court. I'm Peter LaSosa. I'm the attorney for appellant Timothy Spence. We're here for three issues today, Your Honors. First, whether the district court erroneously issued a four-level enhancement under the sentencing guidelines, and if that was in violation of Booker. First, the appellant in his plea agreement did not agree that he was a leader organizer. In fact, he disagreed that he was a leader organizer. It wasn't in the government's indictment that he was a leader organizer. He never waived to that issue for a jury on that issue. Additionally, the government has submitted that the Bryant case stands for the proposition that the judge can continue a fact-finding hearing, and therefore, in the fact-finding hearing, the judge found that he was a leader organizer. However, in the Bryant case, it's distinguishable because in Bryant, the judge actually said there's two issues in the plea agreement that are up for dispute. And therefore, the judge sat down and had both sides present evidence. Mr. Bryant presented pictures of this assault rifle to see if it was a machine gun and a suppressor, and the government called an ATF agent to testify. And after hearing this evidence, the judge made a determination, a finding of fact. In the instant case, we didn't have that. The judge just basically took the probation report and said, I'm going to give him a four-level increase based on this, that he's a leader organizer, even though he had never agreed to that in his plea agreement. And I would respectfully submit that isn't proper and not in keeping with Booker. The second issue, Your Honors, is on ineffective assistance of counsel. I will submit that generally there should be a good record so that the court can determine if there's effective assistance of counsel. And we have a limited record here, but I believe from the limited record we can still see that there was ineffective assistance of counsel. We had really two legal proceedings going on at the same time. We had the three-count indictment on the one hand, and on the other hand we had this request for him to submit his exemplars of handwriting. And what happened was on December 9th, they requested these exemplars, and he refused, and he kept refusing. But we do have the transcript from March 25th, 2004, where his attorney told the district judge that because of Rule 16 and because of post-indictment, I don't believe he has to give his handwriting. And he tells that in open court.
He says he didn't think so. But he asked for continuance and got it. He looked it up, then he told him, yes, you have to give it.
Correct, Your Honor.
And the defendant says they still won't give it.
Correct, Your Honor. And I would respectfully submit that for 4 months, his legal advice has been don't give it. And now in open
legal
court...
Legal advice is he didn't know. He didn't know any better. I mean, what you're talking about. But it didn't affect the defendant's position particularly because when he finally did find out, he had an opportunity to do it, he refused anyway.
Well, I think when he finally found out, he had about a minute, Your Honor. It was in that same proceeding.
Yeah, well, he can do it right then. There was no stopping him from saying his name right on the spot.
Well, Your Honor, I would respectfully submit that where your attorney is telling you legal
your
advice...
Your attorney told him then that he had to sign it, and he said, I won't.
But his attorney told him on March 25th that he didn't have to.
This is at the time we're talking about when he could have signed it, gotten rid of the contempt, and that takes care of the problem. So the decision was your client's, not the attorney's.
Well, I would agree with that, except I would respectfully submit, Your Honor, that his counsel didn't say he was too bright.
I just said that he wasn't guilty of incompetence at that stage of the game. Well, he didn't know ahead of time.
He's giving him two different sets of advice.
Yeah, but when he found out what the law was, he told him what the law was, and he didn't follow it anyway.
And I would respectfully submit that he should have some time to try to process that new legal information that his counsel is now giving him in court.
Sign your name, sir, because there's no legal reason we can prevent your signing your name. And the guy says, no. What reflection do you need?
I move on to issue three, Your Honor.
Before you move on, do you really want to pursue this at all? It is conceivable there's some real problem with the behavior of his client. But if we consider an ineffective assistance claim now, this is the one and only time we will ever consider an ineffective assistance claim. He can't come back in 6 months and make a different argument in the district court. Does your client understand that?
Yes, Your Honor.
Does your client know that in the entire history of the Seventh Circuit, no ineffective assistance claim made on direct appeal has ever succeeded?
No, Your Honor.
And this kind of argument is zero for 114 years. And as your exchange with Judge Bauer showed, this is not going to be the first. Does he really want to pursue this?
Yes, Your Honor. I've given him all of the briefs. I've met with him 3 times and discussed the issues, and he was hoping that we could...
He's kind of a stubborn fellow, isn't he? Yeah.
Yes, he seems to be stubborn.
He's going to go his own way whether or not.
Yes, Your Honor.
Seems to have a large self-destructive streak.
Which is why he's where he is.
Yep.
Go ahead.
On the third issue,
you're appointed to this, weren't you?
Yes, Your Honor.
Carry on.
Thank you. On the third issue, the 851 information. As part of the plea agreement, the government said they would withdraw the 851 as well as count 2, and in return, the defendant, the appellant, would plead guilty to 1 and 3 and also to the contempt charge. However, the judge ends up taking the information from the 851 to enhance the sentence, and the government cites 2 cases, Kohler and Flores, for the proposition that the judge can continue to do that because the original sentence under the statute was 5 to 40 years, and as long as he goes under 40 years, he's not violating anything. However, there's really 2 statutory guidelines. There's the 5 to 40, and there's also the statutory guideline of the federal sentencing. And in that regard, I believe that's where the 851 comes in, because that enhancement really makes it illusory that the 851 and the count 2 were withdrawn. Because the purpose of count of the 851 being withdrawn is the defendant thought his sentence would be reduced and that information wouldn't be used to increase his sentence. If the sentencing judge can then use the 851 information to enhance his sentence for relevant conduct, couldn't he also use count 2 that was withdrawn for relevant conduct to increase the sentence? And as long as he doesn't go over the 40 years, he would still be within the guidelines, and that doesn't seem to be fundamentally fair for the plea bargain.
You ready to rebuttal?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Kraft.
Yes.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Carol Kraft. I'm an assistant United States attorney from the Eastern District of Wisconsin. I also represented the government in this case at the level in front of the district court. It's the government's position that the defendant's 3 issues have no merit whatsoever. With respect to the first issue, it is incorrect that the defendant denied that he was an organizer. His position in the plea agreement at the plea hearing and at sentencing was always that the court could not apply an enhancement for his being an organizer or leader because Booker prohibited it. But he never at any point factually in this record disputed that his conduct amounted to organizing this conspiracy. And in fact, if the court looks at the plea agreement and looks at the factual recitation that the government included in the plea agreement and that the defendant signed pursuant to his plea, the facts actually at page 4 state count 1 involves a marijuana trafficking conspiracy organized by Timothy Spence and Daniel Storm, also known as Daniel Slaughter, whom Spence met in prison. Spence was released from prison in the fall of 2001, and Storm was released from prison in the fall of 2002, at which time Storm came to live at Spence's residence in Romeoville, Illinois. During the fall and winter of 2002 and early 2003, Spence and Storm developed a plan to import marijuana from Mexico to the Midwest for distribution. distribution. To this end, they explored the lease and or purchase of aircraft, and in pursuit of the plan, Storm rented hangar space in West Bend, Wisconsin, and chartered aircraft and pilots for flights to the Texas-Mexican border. Also in pursuit of the plan, Spence traveled to the Texas-Mexican border area, first to El Paso, Texas, and later to McAllen, Texas, where he met with suppliers and arranged for the purchase and importation of large quantities of marijuana across the border.
I don't want to stop you in mid-flight, but we've read it.
Okay. I apologize, Judge, but I think it's important because these same facts were recited by the government attorney at the plea hearing. The same facts were included in the pre-sentence report. At the plea hearing, Mr. Spence told the judge that these were the facts that he was pleading guilty to. At the sentencing hearing, Mr. Spence told the judge that he had no objection to the facts, to the factual recitation that was included in the pre-sentence report. And the pre-sentence report also notes that he did not dispute the government's version. So there was no factual dispute about the facts that make him a leader or an organizer. The only dispute was whether or not the government had to prove that up to a jury beyond a reasonable doubt. Booker clearly says the government did not. And so there was no need for the court to engage in any kind of factual hearing to resolve any factual disputes about the defendant's conduct. Because there really is no issue with respect to whether this enhancement should be applied, there is no merit to the defendant's argument about this on this issue. There's also no merit to his argument that his counsel was ineffective with respect to the handwriting exemplar. And in fact, one of the things that the counsel, I guess, disregarded, and perhaps it's because he wasn't involved in the case at this stage, is the fact that at the time that Mr. Spence first refused to to provide the handwriting and handprinting exemplars.
Rather emphatically, if I recall correctly.
Excuse me?
Rather emphatically, if I recall
correctly. Emphatically. He was represented by a different attorney. He was represented by attorney Lou Wasserman. And if one looks at the record, it shows that Lou Wasserman moved to withdraw on March 5th, effective to February 18th, which is the day after the defendant refused to provide the handwriting exemplars. The record is devoid of any information as to what kind of conversation that Mr. Spence had with Mr. Wasserman about these handwriting exemplars and what Mr. Wasserman's advice was. But I think that the fact that Mr. Wasserman withdrew almost immediately after that certainly suggests something about his relationship with the defendant at that point in time. And I think that the defendant's conduct throughout this suggests that he's somebody who was making up his own mind about what would be in his own best interest. That was certainly clear at the order to show cause hearing where Mr. Spence's second attorney, Mr. Ettinger, said for the first time that he had just received the copy of that order and wanted some time to research it so he could determine whether or not the court had authority to do that under Rule 16. At the next hearing on April 7th, and there is one miscitation in the government's brief, we refer to April 10th, it's April 7th, it was very clear by not only Mr. Ettinger's comments that he realized the court did have authority, but by Judge Callahan's a colloquy with the defendant saying, Mr. Spence, you know, you don't have a Fifth Amendment right. This is not testimonial. Mr. Ettinger says, I've discussed this with my attorney, and this is his position regardless. And so I don't think that it's fair for counsel to claim that Mr. Spence erroneously relied on 4 months of bad advice. He relied on, I would say, his own decision-making about what it is that he thought was in his best interest at that point in time, regardless of what his various counsel may have attributed to him. Now, the last issue is whether or not the 851, I actually didn't really understand this argument. Title 21, 851 is a statute that it gives the prosecutor's discretion to raise the statutory minimums and maximum for certain offenses, certain drug offenses. And we filed an 851 information in this case, which increased the defendant's potential sentence from a minimum of 10 years to a maximum of life, from a minimum of 5 to a maximum of 40. During the plea negotiations, we agreed to dismiss that information, and we did, which then dropped his potential sentence back to 5 to 40 years. He was sentenced within that sentencing range. He was in no way prejudiced by the fact that the guidelines also allow the court to take into consideration somebody's past criminal history. And I believe that the cases that we've cited, Flores and Kohler, both stand for the proposition that these two things are distinct. They're legally distinct entities, the guideline provisions that allow a court to take into consideration certain things, and the statutory scheme that allows the government to increase a defendant's potential sentence. He was accorded his rights pursuant to the plea agreement. He was sentenced within the 5 to 40 year range that was required by charging that did not include the 851 enhancement. And there just there just doesn't seem to be any merit to that argument. He raises a couple of other issues with respect to how the court calculated his criminal history. And frankly, I'm also a little astonished by those because the court gave Mr. Spence a big break in this case. The court ought to have considered him to be a career offender based on the fact that he had two prior drug convictions. But the court said, because Booker seems to say now that under indeterminate sentencing I can consider other factors, I'm not going to consider the defendant to be a career offender.
It wasn't the court that did him a big favor. It was the United States that did him a big favor by not taking a cross appeal. Because in the interim, we have adopted the very position that the district court rejected with respect to the career offender rules.
Well, I, with respect to this defendant, however, I mean, it's amazing to me that he's here complaining about the way the court treated his
criminal history. It's certainly the case that if he were resentenced now, his sentence would have to be higher. He would have to be sentenced as a career offender.
I would say that that would be correct. Yes, I would agree with the court.
But we've already agreed that he's self-destructive.
At any rate, in summary, unless the court has more questions of me, it's the United States' position that there is no merit to any of these three issues and that he has not provided any basis for the court to vacate his sentencing and send him back for resentencing. And I would ask the court to deny his appeal.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sorry I went so fast and got so excited.
That's okay.
Thank you, Ms. Kravitz. Anything further, Mr. LaSorsa?
I just wanted to clear up one issue, Your Honor.
I didn't want to leave the court with the impression that on the as to issue one on the leader organizer, it's my understanding, and I'm looking at page 5 of the actual sentencing transcript. The judge says, as an example, count one, the government must prove two elements. First, the conspiracy existed to distribute marijuana, and second, you knowingly became a member of the conspiracy. And so it's my understanding, if you become a member of a conspiracy, you can't organize it or lead it. You're becoming a member of it. And so I think the judge was, what he agreed to.
You think conspiracies have no leaders?
They do, but if he's joining the conspiracy, it already has to exist.
He took over. There you go.
Well,
this conversation before that in the original plea agreement sets him out very clearly as the organizer with one other guy. You have to have somebody else to organize with. You can't, yeah.
Correct, Your Honor. Well, I think his position is that Storm organized it and then he joined it. I guess my position, though, is that the judge set out exactly the two things that the government was going to prove, and the second thing was that he joined the conspiracy as opposed to he was leading it or he was organizing it. And that was my only point I'd like to make. Thank you.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you, Mr. LaSorsa. We appreciate your willingness to accept the appointment in this case. The assistance you've been both to your client and the court.
Thank you.
Thank you. Case is taken under advisement, and the court will be in recess until tomorrow.